This is Wednesday, November the 1st, study on God's salvation through history. We're starting lesson 4 this evening. And in this, one of the things that we find that plays kind of an important part in the workings of God, and we'll see this somewhat, if just as a side note, that you can look and kind of look for the things, and you'll see them, that they are prevalent in the actions that the Lord does when He delivers His people. But we find in the workings of God in the Old Testament that God had man use tangible, inanimate objects in His instructions. And by that I mean there are certain things that, whether they're right or wrong, they play their role in the interactions between God and man. And He had man use things, or He instructed man to use things also, when they were going about to do certain things. And in these inanimate, tangible things that they used, you'll see over time that somehow that man started placing a little bit more confidence in them than within God. But again, whether it's right or wrong, you can study that. But they did play a role. Some were for memorials that God instructed the people to do, such as the stones that were set in places, so that when they were asked about the stones, and the story was to be relayed to the younger generations. You remember in Joshua chapter 4, verses 1 through 7, as they had crossed the Jordan, there were supposed to be stones that were set up, 12 stones, where the Levites' feet were, the priests' feet were. And it was told that when the younger generation sees those, why, you're to be able to tell them what the Lord did. And it was set as a memorial on that. So you had those things that were used. You had the stones in Exodus, the 28th chapter, verses 6 through 14. The stones that was put into the ephod of Aaron the high priest, and it was for a memorial as Aaron wore it. And so the stones represented the 12 tribes of Israel, or the children of Israel, and therefore it was as a memorial in that. The Urim and the Thummim in the breastplate that the high priest wore for judgment, or directions from God. We see in Exodus, the 28th chapter, and verse 30, and in Numbers 27, 21, and 1 Samuel 28, 6, that it played an important part when Saul had questions concerning, well, you know, should we do this or should we not? Then he called for the Urim and the Thummim to see what God would answer. And, you know, if God answered, then things were fine. If God didn't answer through it, then they were left with, well, you know, we're not sure what to do, because there wasn't a declared answer from God. The brass serpent that you have in Numbers, the 21st chapter, verses 6 through 9, it was set on a pole to offer healing to those who had been bitten by the fiery serpents. And it was later turned into an idol by Israel that you read about in 2 Kings 18, chapter verse 4. The thing had a purpose. God instructed them to build the brass serpent and to set it up, and those that would look upon it would be cured of the fiery bite that the serpent gave them. They would not die. God could have took any means and had them recover from that illness, but yet He said, you construct a brass serpent and you put it on a pole. And it wasn't that there was anything spectacular in that or special concerning that, but it was God the one that was delivering them. But it was from the standpoint that they had to look upon it, and then God did deliver them from the sickness or the disease of death with that bite. So in that, in some of these things, when you see that and you see with this, that it was later turned into an idol, which they kept for over this period of time, and they worshipped it because it became an idol to them, that it soon replaced God. Because they saw that then after a while, as that was the source of looking upon it, that we got deliverance and it wasn't from God Himself, or they just kind of pushed God to the side, or for whatever reason, I don't know. But the rod of Moses and Aaron, it was to convince the people of Israel that God was with Moses and Aaron. God had instructed them to do certain things with it. And it was to show them that God was with them. The rod was to be seen when you go through Exodus and the plagues. The rod was to be seen when it was used against Pharaoh. Moses and Aaron and them were told to lift up the rod, to lift it up during the plagues. And so therefore it would be seen and used in the presence of Israel. The rod was at the Red Sea. Moses was told to lift it up and to part the waters in Exodus 14:16. So therefore, you have this visual of Moses lifting up the rod, or even there in the plagues with Pharaoh, Pharaoh would see the rod going up, and then he would see the plagues coming about. The children saw the rod being lifted up, and then the waters being parted in that. And those things in the wilderness, you realize that when they had to strike the rock for water or whatever, the rod was used. God said, you strike the rock with the rod and water will come forth. In the battles, in Exodus 17th chapter and verse 9, it was raised the rod. The rod was being raised to prevail. As soon as Moses put his hands down, they started losing the battle. As soon as his hand went back up with the rod, they started winning the battle. And there seems to be something all along those lines as you go through. And as I say, I can see the raising of the rod as far as placing it high to show maybe the source was from heaven in that respect, in that aspect. But then the people, as we are, we end up placing more emphasis on the tangible things than we do on the source of it. And as a case in point today, you have a memorial that people make of the cross. And sometimes more emphasis is put in the cross than as far as the work that Jesus did and the work that God the Father did. And so therefore, sometimes you have the cross that, even though it's a memorial, it could end up becoming an idol or idolized in that respect by people. So, as Moses is going through the wilderness, they had the rod that was in that direction. But then, when he got in the wilderness and they started having their tabernacle with them, there was a piece of article that they were instructed to make, and that was an ark. And it was one of the pieces of furniture for the tabernacle. And we know in Exodus chapter 25, verses 10 through 20, that it was to be ornately covered in gold with a golden mercy seat and two cherubims on top facing each other. And when you think about it, its dimensions were 2.5 cubits long by 1.5 cubits wide and 1.5 cubits high. With a cubit being about 18 inches, the ark would be around 3'9" long by 2'3" wide and 2'3" high. So it's going to be something that's going to be visible, and it would have been of such beautiful construction that it would have been gazed upon with awe if it was allowed to be seen. And there were those that did see it. The heathen nations did see it, and they were struck with awe with it. So you have this piece of furniture, this piece of article that God instructed them to make. And the significance of it, that was above the Ark of the Covenant, was where God said that he would commune with Moses and the people. And so you consider the significance of such action, God coming down and communicating with the people in Exodus chapter 25 and verse 22. He's actually coming there. And so they start associating the communion with God, or God directing them and so forth, above the ark, and that's where God was with that ark. And that's where he came. And so you can see that within this ark and what was placed in it, you had the testimony of God that was given to them in Exodus chapter 25, verses 16 and 21, and in Deuteronomy 31, 24 through 26, the tablets were to be in there, which was the writings from God, or the law from God. You also find that there were other items that were contained within the ark besides the words of the law. There was the rod that budded, and then there was the manna, according to Exodus 16, 33 and 34, and Hebrews 9, 4. So you had those items contained within the ark. And the ark itself played an important role with the children of Israel. Just the same as they got to where they were looking at whenever Moses raised his rod, you figured something was going to happen. Or you realized that something was taking place with it when he was either bringing about the plagues or striking the rocks and so forth. But it was with the ark also. The ark had that role in the journeys of the children of Israel, that it was the leading object that was carried by the Levites. And when it moved, they would move. When it didn't move, they didn't move. Now, we already saw before in the classes prior that there was an angel that was guiding them, that was going to fight for them, be with them, but also it was by the ark also that when it moved, they moved. And they were always proceeding after the ark. The ark was before them, and they would follow afterwards. And it became of such a thing when it was carried by them that even not only they had a lot of reverence for the ark, and, you know, I'm not, again, whether right or wrong, you know, they had a lot of reverence for the ark, and also the heathen nations had a lot of reverence for the ark. And they associated the power of God, Jehovah, with that ark. When it got captured by the Philistines and taken with the Philistines and so forth, they couldn't get rid of it quick enough because it created so many problems. The men started getting tumors where the ark was. When they captured it and took it to the various cities, they started getting tumors and so forth. And when they did, they, you know, get it out here, take it somewhere else, it went somewhere else. They started getting sick with it. And finally, they called, you know, what do we do with it? Well, send it back to Israel. You know, this is the workings of God, and, you know, you got to send it back. So that's when they ended up putting it on the new cart with the cows and sent it back on the road, and the cows found their way back to Israel, and the ark was delivered back. But the problem with that is that they started placing a lot of importance in the ark itself. And somewhat that diminished from the standpoint that, well, it wasn't God, it's this thing. What's this thing doing? What's the ark going to tell us? What's it going to do? That's where our power is. If we've got the ark with us, then we're going to win the battle. And there was a lot of that comments going on in their battles that, you know, they were wanting the ark there. Bring the ark up. Let's have the ark here. That way we know if the ark is here, we're going to win. And they started associating their deliverance with the Ark of the Covenant instead of God. And he would deliver them whether there was an ark there or whether there wasn't. That was within God's power and God's control. But we know in Numbers, the 14th chapter, verses 41 through 45, that the Ark of the Covenant did not move and lead them forward in the battle because God wasn't with them. And Israel lost the battle. They went out the battle and they lost it because the ark didn't go. And that was because of their transgressions and so forth right before that, that God didn't, he wasn't with them. So that brought a lot of thought to them as far as the emphasis. And there was such great confidence that was placed in the object of the Ark of the Covenant that great faith and trust in God himself was replaced and put into the ark. It was something tangible to see, and it was something they could put their faith and trust in. When you look at 1 Samuel, the 4th chapter, third verse, and when the people were coming to the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Wherefore hath the Lord smitten us today before the Philistines? Let us fetch the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord out of Shiloh unto us, that when it cometh among us, it may save us out of the hand of our enemies." No reliance there upon God, but it was fully placed upon the Ark. It, let it save us. Go fetch it, bring it, and it will save us. And you had that going. I mean, it may have been the same thing with the brazen serpent. When they got relief from the fiery serpent's bite, they may have thought, well, that's the thing that's going to save us. So that's why they idolized it, you know, during that time. They could have done the same thing with the rod of Moses, but I do know that they did with the ark because of their actions. The reason this trust and confidence was placed in the Ark of the Covenant was due to its importance in their battles and the resulting effect that it had on the other nations and those other nations fearing the Ark of the Covenant. When they realized that Israel was there, and when they heard that the Ark of the Covenant had come to Israel, they panicked. They panicked because then they knew God's going to be fighting for them. When you look at the fourth chapter again, where we're at, 1 Samuel, verses 5 through 8. Then when the ark of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel shouted with a great shout, so that the earth rang again. And when the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, they said, "What meaneth the noise of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews?" And they understood that the ark of the Lord was coming to the camp. And the Philistines were afraid, for they said, "God has come into the camp." And they said, "Woe unto us, for there hath not been such a thing heretofore. Woe unto us, who shall deliver us out of the hand of these mighty gods? Are these the gods that smote the Egyptians and all the plagues in the wilderness?" They still went. When God had said that the fear, if you remember when we talked about earlier in the classes, that the fear that he would send out among the heathen nations ahead of time concerning the children of Israel, we see this playing out, that God did do that. When they saw and heard about what Israel had done, and what God had done in Egypt and how they were delivered and so forth, that fear went out to all the other nations, regardless of how mighty they were. And so they knew the power of God. But here again, they're saying, well, you know, it's the ark. In the fifth chapter there, 1 Samuel, verse 7, you have there where the nations were, again, as I mentioned, that the ark was captured. They got in verses 7, 9, and 10, they got tumors in them, and they wanted to get rid of it. So, again, the fear is recognized there and placed with the ark. It's a misplaced fear because the fear should have been with God. That's where it should have been with God, not in the instruments that he was using or the instruments that he had them make. And people do that today. Sometimes we can take some of the things that are associated with religion and put the fear in them and have the fear with them instead of with God where it should lay. So bear that in mind when you look at some of these battles and look at the importance of how did the Ark of the Covenant come into play? You know, how did it operate in this? And you'll see that that's what kind of led them somewhat into maybe some of their idolatrous thoughts and ideas as far as what they were associating the ark with and not giving it unto God. Jeremiah said in Jeremiah the third chapter, and I thought it was kind of interesting, in the third chapter of Jeremiah, that there would come a point in time that the Ark of the Covenant would pass from their memories, that they would no longer be thinking about that. Jeremiah, the third chapter, verses 14. "Though turn, O backsliding children, saith the Lord, for I am married unto you, and I will take you, one of a city and two of a family, and I will bring you to Zion. And I will give you pastors according to my heart, which shall feed you with knowledge and understanding. And it shall come to pass, when ye be multiplied and increased in the land in those days, saith the Lord, they shall say no more, the ark of the covenant of the Lord. Neither shall it come to mind. Neither shall they remember it, neither shall they visit it, neither shall that be done anymore." So even God declared that there was going to come a time that when that ark would be forgotten out of their memory and the importance that it played on them. Okay? Any thought or comment on that? Okay. If you would turn to Deuteronomy, the 20th chapter. When they went into these battles, even though they weren't a fighting nation yet, God had some very explicit rules for Israel concerning those who would serve in battle for Israel. And we find the concepts of faith, trust, confidence, remembrance, and encouragement being brought before the people before each battle. And this was done before each battle. Even though God had already told them time and time again that we looked at, that he would be fighting for them, that he would be the one that, you know, would gain them victory and that they would be achieved victory. And, you know, you're going to have this lamb. I'm going to drive them out. There were still these items that needed to be accomplished in their mind in this. In the 20th chapter, he talks about the things that, as far as the rules of, I'm not going to say engagement, but the rules of the ones that would be fighting. And when you look at it, he said, when thou goest out to battle against their enemies, and you see horses and chariots, and a people more than you, be not afraid of them. For the Lord your God is with thee, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. Again, bringing them to remembrance what happened out of the land of Egypt. Remember that. What happened? What did God do? And that's what he keeps impressing upon their mind. And it shall be when you come nigh unto the battle that the priest shall approach and speak unto the people and shall say unto them, Hear, O Israel, ye approach this day into battle against your enemies. Let not your hearts faint, fear not, and do not tremble, neither be ye terrified because of them. For the Lord your God is he that goeth with you to fight for you against your enemies to save you. Again, the reassurance and the confidence coming from the priest telling the people ahead of time, when you see this, don't be afraid of it. Don't be scared. God's fighting for you and God will prevail. And the officers shall speak unto the people saying, What man is there that hath built a new house and hath not dedicated it? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man dedicate it. And what man is he that hath planted a vineyard and hath not eaten of it? Let him also go and return into his house, lest he die in the battle and another man eat of it. And what man is there that hath betrothed a wife and hath not taken her? Let him go and return into his house, lest he die in the battle and another man take her. Bear in mind that the betrothal, under the Hebrew custom, when you become betrothed, it was as if you were married. And that's why the laws of divorcement were the way that they were as far as the writing of divorcements and so forth. When you were betrothed, engaged, what we would call it, they were considered legally as married in the betrothal. They were considered that way. And so that could take a number of months. How long? Who knows? You know, that was up to the parties involved. And so therefore, the man that hath betrothed the wife, he could be sitting out of battle for, you know, 6 months to a year. So you're seeing some of this in this of the population coming down, of the able men that would be able to serve. In verse 8, and the officers shall speak further unto people, and they shall say, What man is there that is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go and return into his house, lest his brother's heart faint as well as his heart. And it shall be when the officers have made an end of speaking unto the people that they shall make captains of the armies to lead the people. When thou comest nigh unto the city to fight against it, then proclaim peace unto it. And it shall be, if it make thee answer of peace and open unto thee, then it shall be that all the people that is found therein shall be tributaries unto thee, and they shall serve you. And if they will not make no peace with you, but will make war against you, then you shall besiege it. War back then wasn't like it was or is today. There was a besieging. The cities were built, fortified, that when they were shut up, you would have to sit outside and wait and wait and wait and besiege it and try to wait them out. And then along those lines also came the battlement rams and so forth to try to break the walls down. So the battle wasn't an easy thing. But he says here that you will make war against it, then thou shalt besiege it, and when the Lord thy God hath delivered it into your hands, you shall smite every male thereof with the edge of the sword. But the women and the little ones and the cattle and all these in the city, even all the spoil thereof, thou shalt take unto yourself, and thou shalt eat the spoil of your enemies, which the Lord thy God hath given you. Thus shalt you do unto all the cities which are very far off from thee, which are not of the cities of these nations. But of these people whom the God, Lord thy God, doth give thee for an inheritance, they have a different set of instructions. And those instructions, of course, you can go back to the ones that were given as inheritance, the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites. Thou shalt save nothing. Thou shalt save alive nothing that breatheth. nothing. They were to be totally exterminated. But thou shalt utterly destroy them, namely the Hittites, the Amorites, Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and Jebusites, as the Lord thy God hath commanded you. For here's the reason, that they teach you not to do after all their abominations which they have done unto their gods. So should ye sin against the Lord your God. When thou shalt besiege a city a long time and making war against it to take it, thou shalt not destroy the trees thereof by forcing an axe against them, for thou mayest eat of them, and thou shalt not cut them down. For the tree of the field is man's life, to employ them in the siege. Only the trees which you knowest that they may be not trees for me, thou shalt destroy and cut them down. Thou shalt build bulwarks against the city that maketh war with thee until it be subdued. Some strange rules and regulations for war, but that's how God had it. So you can see how Israel wasn't going to be winning their battles by the mighty. And they were even restricted on what trees to cut down that they could use. Again, it was God doing it. There was encouragement to put trust in God because of what they had already witnessed. And that was something that he kept reminding them in the 7th chapter of Deuteronomy. Over and over again, the remembrance of what had been done, they had to keep in mind. And what God had done, this would have been the encouragement that would have gave them the trust, the confidence that they needed in times of battle. The 7th chapter of Deuteronomy, verses 16, thou shalt consume all the people which the Lord thy God shall deliver thee. Thy eyes shall have no pity upon them, neither shalt thou serve their gods, for they will be a snare unto you. And if thou shalt say in your heart, these nations are more than I, how can I dispossess them? Thou shalt not be afraid of them, but shalt well remember what the Lord thy God did unto Pharaoh and to all Egypt. The great temptations which your eyes saw, and the signs and the wonders and the mighty hand and the stretched out arm whereby the Lord thy God brought you out, so shall the Lord thy God do unto all the people of whom you are afraid. Moreover, the Lord thy God will send a hornet among them until they that are left and hide themselves from you be destroyed. Thou shalt not be affrighted at them, for the Lord thy God is among you, a mighty God and terrible. That's the description of God, a mighty God and terrible. Prayer of David in Psalms, the 20th chapter. We know David had a lot of pursuits in his time. He had a lot of conflict in his time. He had a lot of opposition. In Psalms, the 20th chapter, David said in verse 5, we will rejoice in thy salvation, and in the name of our God we will set our banners. The Lord fulfill all thy petitions. Now know I that the Lord saveth his anointed. He will hear him from his holy heaven with the saving strength of his right hand. Some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we will remember the name of our Lord our God. They are brought down and fallen, but we are risen and stand upright. Save, Lord, let the king hear us when we call. Banners played an important part in warfare also and in the nations. The nations were known by their banners that they carried with them. It kind of described where they were from and something about them. It's kind of like, in an ocean and on a ship, if you saw a black flag and you saw a skull and crossbones, you knew what type of ship it was. You knew it was going to be a pirate ship. You knew things wasn't going to turn out good. When you see banners, you knew what nations it was going to be and what type of people they were going to be. And here David says, God is going to be their banner. He was their banner. And God is above all. So he was the one that's going to be successful and win all the battles for them. So again, the thought is on that he was going to do that. Okay? We'll go ahead and start in lesson 5 here and start looking at some of the battles in the short time that we have. As we look at the various deliverances from distress, servitude, wars, and enemies, let us consider what opposition the people of God faced and see how God worked their salvation and delivered them by His mercy. The first one we're going to get into is Genesis, the 14th chapter. And you have the battle of Abram here in the 14th chapter of Genesis. Verses 1 through 24. And in this, in the battle of Abraham, it starts out, the recording is of the four kings are battling against the five kings. You have the kings of Shinar, Elasar, Elam, Goyim, versus the kings of Sodom, Gomorrah, Admar, Zeboim, and Zoar. And you have those nine kings, four battling five. Now, you can understand that back in that time when you had an area, you know, they're talking about the city of Sodom and Gomorrah. Well, here you have kings of these cities. And that's it wasn't like kings over a big area reign like Caesar was or whatever. These are over particular cities and kings. But yet they still had a big force. They would band together and group together to fight others. So you had four kings battling five kings. Well, the five kings lost to the four kings. And in that battle, of course, we know where Abraham's nephew Lot was, because he took the side with the five kings, and of course they lost. So Abram's nephew Lot, along with all his goods and the women and the people, were taken captive. And they were carried off. Now here's Abram. Abram mostly had flocks. He was a herdsman. As far as I know, he didn't have any military experience. It's not recorded he had any fightings, that he was well versed in military actions and so forth. But he took 318 of his servants, and he armed them, and they went to battle against the four kings. Now these four kings already defeated five kings. And here's Abram, 318 people. And so he sets out, and he goes, and Abram prevailed. And he smote the four kings, and he brought back Lot and his families along with the spoil from the battle. And we see that God is credited with the victory, and God is glorified due to his deliverance of Lot through Abram. And that's when Melchizedek came to him and spoke to Abram. And we see the humbleness, of course we're familiar with that as far as Abraham, in not wanting to accept the spoil, and giving God all the credit for winning the battle. It wasn't Abram and it wasn't the 318 men that defeated the four kings and their armies. But he attributed it to God. So when you read that, think of the application of what we can learn. And one of the things we can learn is deliverance should not be looked upon as from God, as from us. It should be looked upon from God and not from us. Okay? Abram didn't say, well, it was me, or it was my 318 people. But it was looked upon as from God. And the second thing is that personal gain was not the motive for or after the deliverance. It wasn't for personal gain that he went to deliver Lot. It wasn't for personal gain that he won. And after he had won the battle, it still was not for personal gain. Okay, because he was willing to give it up. He realized it came from God. Okay, so just some thoughts on that. That's the first battle that we're looking at. That God delivered Lot from the kings by Abram and the 318 servants that he had with him. They were quite outnumbered. Thank you.